pale deadness of her heavenly body pitched back and forth between the clouds, one minute illuminating the scrub sage and sparse tufts of buffalo grass, and the next hiding her face completely. The snow had slackened for the moment, but I was betting that wouldn't last. The road was slightly rutted, and nothing had attempted to grow again in the running depressions that the oil men had grooved in their hurry to drill. Environmentalists had pointed out just how fragile the crusted surface of the high desert is, and how it would take hundreds of years for the land to repair itself. I could see where the drillers had forged new roads across the tundra in an attempt to make money in a place where time equaled cash and expedience meant jobs. I hoped that they had blown an engine. The four-wheeler had made my tracking a little easier by staying on the main road, but I figured with the advantage of an internal combustion pace, they had a good 40 minutes on both Herschel and me. Dog's prints came and went, as if he'd been trailing the ATV but hadn't wanted to be seen. That, or I'd watched too many episodes of Rin Tin Tin. I let out a deep sigh and watched as my breath joined with that of my horse and trailed southeast, following the road. My hands and face had gotten a little numb, which at least made my cheekbone feel a little better, if nothing else. It was snowing harder, and the flakes stuck to the right side of everything, including the horses and me. But with the perversity and volatility of Wyoming weather, it seemed to be getting a little warmer. There were flashes of lightning in the clouds to the west, and it was possible that the wet snow would turn to rain. I switched hands and discovered an old pair of buffalo gloves my wife had given to me decades ago in my between-seasons jacket pocket. I pulled the gloves on, tied off my scarf at my throat a little tighter, and cranked my hat down again, dipping my head a little to protect my exposed ear and busted cheek. Now I looked the part completely and remembered why I didn't like cowboying. I pulled at the stiff collar of my jacket to try to protect the side of my face and could feel the ache at the top of my once frostbitten ear. The road turned west after a few miles, and it was a relief to be facing the wind. I tipped my head down and rocked back and forth as the bay plodded on. The urge to hurry ran through my blood like fractured streaks of lightning imitating the bursts overhead, and I thought about Benjamin and the Dust Devil, but the pack horse couldn't take speed, and all I'd find was an empty trailer for my troubles anyway. We continued on, and I could just see something in the sporadic lightning that continued to illuminate the mesa. It had to be the horse trailer. I nudged the bay, and we came to the wide spot of the road at a trot. The trailer was as we'd left it, except that there was a pile of blankets, some feed buckets and ropes, a half bag of oats, and Herschel's prized canteen near the back of the end stall. The rear door of the trailer was held open with a hooked rubber strap, but not enough to stop it from rhythmically tattooing against the metal flanks. Upon closer study, there was also a fluttering piece of paper on top of the blankets with a large rock holding it as a paperweight. Something moved on the top of the trailer, and the bay spooked again. I reeled him in with a rap on the reins, my free hand on the colt at my back. The next uneven streak of lightning revealed the horned owl. He was seated on the sliding rail of the horse trailer, and he was about half the size of Benjamin. He turned his gigantic head and stared at me with eyes as gold as others I knew. "Hello again." He didn't move, and continued to stare at me for a moment. Then he looked disgusted and flew off. I watched and listened to his wings slap the air as he circled south. "I was just kidding about holding my calls." There was no dun horse tied off or inside the trailer. The tiny alarms began ringing in the distance in my head, and I could feel the familiar cooling of my face and the stillness of my hands. I pulled the big colt from the small of my back and wheeled the bay into a tight circle where I could see the surrounding area. The pack horse balked along with the pony, but then they both circled around and looked off into the darkness south, just as they all had when we'd first arrived and saddled up. I didn't know what to look for as I peered into the remoteness of the South Mesa. I knew that they couldn't see as well as I could, but that they could feel more. I wondered what or who they were feeling. Chapter 13, October 30th, 10 p.m. The pencil was blunt, and Herschel's handwriting and spelling was pretty bad, but I could still make out the gist of it. Sheriff, radio did not work and truck was gone when I got here. Dropped off the extra stuff and went downhill and back to town. I suppose Bill decided he needed his truck after all. Your dog was here, his leg is hurt, and he's limping bad, so I threw him over the saddle and took him. Herschel. P.S. I left the canteen for you, but took the radio just in case it works, and will be back soon with the cavalry. I studied the note. It was odd that he'd misspelled the word radio the first time, but then spelled it correctly in the postscript. I tied my bay and the Gruya off to the trailer and unloaded the pack horse. There wasn't that much water left, so I just emptied the plastic containers into the buckets, collected the canteen for myself, and took the flashlight over toward the head of the trailer. There were boot prints and ones from running shoes, and I shined the maglite in the granules of gritty snow that had collected in them. I placed one of my feet beside one of the boot prints. It was definitely from a shoe that was a couple of sizes smaller than my own. I circled around the other side of the trailer and picked up the four-wheeler's tire marks, which circled to the left and back to the road. When I got to the two-track dirt road, I could see that Herschel had made for town, but the ATV and Julie both turned and went east. Dogs' prints were everywhere, and it was difficult to tell which were new ones and which ones were from before. I stood there for a moment, registering what it all meant. I walked past the back of the trailer to where Benjamin and I had stood earlier. I looked off to the south and remembered the turnoff that we had seen that was just ahead. I started walking and pulled Herschel's canteen from my shoulder, unscrewed the top, and took a swig. It tasted like a Civil War mud puddle, and I was immediately sorry I'd given the horses all the water. I screwed the cap back on and slung the canteen back over my shoulder. The tracks continued to the cutoff and then abruptly turned. Whoever had the boy had gone south, but had the truck met the four-wheeler, followed them, or gone ahead. No matter what had happened, the boy was south. I went back to the trailer with the idea of writing a note, but then couldn't find anything to write with. I hung the canteen over the horn of the bay's saddle, pulled the extra ammunition and clip I'd brought in the saddlebags, and dumped it all into the pockets of my jacket. The wind had stopped, but the cloud cover was getting heavier, and it looked like there might be more precipitation. I buttoned up my jacket, regloved, put a foot into the stirrup, and saddled up. I hadn't been on horseback this much in years. I felt the weight of the large frame colt against the small of my back and started off. I followed the road with the flashlight beam leading the way. I looked into the darkness south and watched as the lightning continued to pound the battlement like artillery fire. I clicked the maglite off, flipped up the saddlebag cover, and dropped it inside. No sense advertising. October 26th. 4 days earlier, afternoon. I had placed my hat on the handle of the semi-automatic, crossed my arms, and softly exhaled, afraid I would break the spell. The voice told you to go in the house? Mary Barsad studied the bedsheets, her eyes wide and staring, as if she was seeing that night over again.
Yes. He said for me to go into the house.
You said he again. She thought, and I watched her.
It's always the same voice. A male voice.
Do you recognize it?
Yes. I mean, it's familiar.
Who is it?
She took a deep breath of her own, and you could see the frustration tensing her body.
Her eyes searched the sheets, and her brow furrowed the lines deep between her eyes. I was afraid that she would lose the story, and she almost panicked
at losing the story herself. I went into the house, and I remember that he'd killed my horses. Wahoo-Su, my horse. There'd been a catch in her breath, and she plucked at the blanket before she spoke again. The bedroom. I remember going into the bedroom, and it was strange because the lights were off. I spoke gently. Was he asleep? Yes. Even more gently. But if he was? No. He always slept with the lights on because he said he could. It had something to do with the time he'd spent in prison. Like those little lists of paper he kept. The kites? Yes. Those.
October 30th, 10:35 p.m. There's nothing romantic about a dead body. And the romantic poets notwithstanding, there's nothing romantic about death. About 30 minutes down the road, the bay skidded to the left and tried to rear. I was getting tired of his nervousness and was prepared. I wrapped the reins again and stayed put, allowing the big horse to back away but not turn and run. Something was out there a little ahead, something the horse didn't like. I didn't want a chance riding him closer, but I didn't relish the idea of walking around out here trying to find him in the dark either. The closest thing I could find to tie him off to was a sprig of dead blue sage. It was brittle, but looked strong enough to hold the bay unless he was really determined. I stepped off, comforting him with my voice and wishing I knew his name. Easy, easy boy. I thought of reaching into my saddlebag for the maglite, decided against it, and then changed my mind, figuring that if there were someone out there, they probably already knew I was here. I got the flashlight and then unclipped and slipped the .45 from the pancake holster at my back. I clicked off the safety and spoke to the horse again, looking into the white of his eye. Easy, easy now. I ran my eyes over the surrounding area, left the horse, and continued down the dirt road. 20 yards further, I could see that there was a spot where the big Dodge had slid to a stop and then continued. I clicked on the tactical flashlight and could plainly see that there were running shoe prints again. It was the driver who was wearing them, and I could see where he'd yanked the truck to a lurching stop, jumped out of the cab, and run around the back. I followed his tracks into the scrub weed and Johnson grass. There were boot tracks now as well, and it appeared as if the booted man had jumped from the passenger side and then been chased by the man in running shoes. There wouldn't be anybody coming to my rescue tonight. I found his hat first, lodged against one of the skeletal hands of dead sage. The battered beaver fur was brim up, and the hat struggled against the dry branches, unable to escape their grip. I could see the stained white sateen of the liner beckoning like the whites of the horse's eyes I'd just left. I picked up the hat, rescuing it from the cruel, punishing wind of oblivion. He was another 20 yards from the road. He must have been trying to angle back toward the trailer. He'd been shot in the back and then again in the back of the head at close range, both from the look of the wounds, 9mm. His hands were duct-taped together. I squatted by the old cowboy and nudged my own hat back, running my gloved hand across my face and placing the other on his shoulder to steady myself and maybe to provide some solace to his soul. I suddenly felt very tired. Well, hell. Evidently, Herschel had jumped from the truck and tried to run for it, but whoever he was attempting to escape from had chased after him and placed one of the 9mm slugs between the old cowboy's shoulder blades and slightly to the right. As the puncher had tried to crawl away, the shooter had calmly walked over, lowered his weapon, and finished the job. I'm so sorry, Herschel. I crouched there for a while because it was the only thing I had the energy for.
I watched one of the stark flashes of lightning strike no more than a mile away. The quick succession of explosive noise and reverberation through my boots, telling me to move. I sighed and took one last look at the old cowboy, wondering how much blame I carried for his demise. It wasn't how the old fellow should have passed. On the mesa, executed. I made a promise to myself. October 30th, 10:52 p.m. I piled some rocks on top of Herschel's hat and sat there on the side of the road. Who would have wanted to do such a thing? I felt another wave of sadness and that peculiar weariness that only overtakes you with the weight of a world gone bad. I took a deep breath and pushed off from the ground. I felt like the stack of rocks. I looked back in the distance and thought about how easy it was to lose a body in this country, how quickly the scavengers and the weather could dispose of it and scatter you. I also thought of something Bill Nolan had said in his truck about personal history. If nobody remembered you, were you ever really here? I made a silent promise to not forget Herschel, and then slowly approached the bay that had grown more skittish with the proximity of the lightning. Easy, easy now. Despite recent developments, or maybe because of them, I again felt a wave of exhaustion as I hooked a hand on the horn of the saddle and draped the .45 Colt over the seat. I pushed my hat back again and placed my damaged cheek against the cool leather of the saddle and just stood there. I could smell the rich, earthy scent of the leather, the horse, and the strong ozone of low-slung clouds. Something was troubling me. Something that tied all these events together, dot to dot, like one of those games that kids get on restaurant menus. I turned my face and saw something move to the south. Probably the owl again. Maybe he had been delivering a message after all. There was another lightning strike. It was close. And the bay lurched just a few inches, but enough to strike the saddle against my injured cheek. I stood there for a moment more with my eyes closed, breathing through the pain, and thought about the ferocious burst of the big owl's wings on the trail and at the trailer. But it wasn't the owl. It was something else, something similar. I guess my mind wasn't working. I stowed the Colt in the holster at my back, fixed my hat, and pulled the dead man's canteen from the saddle horn, unscrewed the top, and took another draft. It still tasted bad, but with more of a bitter, metallic taste than mud puddle. It was probably from the liner. I replaced the canteen, looking at the beads on its face with the twin bird insignia. I thought that what was bothering me was about a bird, but not about an owl. And I thought about the meadowlark I'd seen sitting on Kyle Straub's sign outside the hospital when I had been questioning Mary last week. It was something about the meadowlark, something about it not sounding right. One strike of lightning followed another in succession, and I felt the tingling of intimidation in being the tallest point on the big mesa. Then I slipped a boot into the stirrup and made myself taller. The bay behaved and only took a few steps to the left to avoid the smell of the dead man. I swayed in the saddle for a moment and felt a mild nausea. It must have been a drop in blood pressure from the exertion and the exhaustion. I've seen enough dead bodies, but maybe Herschel had deeply ingrained himself in my psyche in the short time I'd known him. One thing I knew was that the world was a little bit poorer from his loss, and that it was my job tonight to right the scales. I yawned, cursed, and thought about the meadowlark again. Why was it my mind had suddenly decided to mimic the horse I rode and jump left? I thumbed my eyes. Was it Herschel's dead body the horses had sensed at the trailer, or was it something else? Maybe it was the Meadowlark. Why the hell was I continuing to think about the damn Meadowlarks? I started with a jerk at the thought so that the bay stopped and looked back at me. I pulled the reins through my fingers, kneed him just slightly to get him going again, and looked at the canvas cover of the canteen, at the stenciled letters faded from the years. I was tired. It was two Meadowlarks. I looked down, and my head began nodding with the rhythm of the horse as he continued on. The next volley of lightning struck even farther south, down near the tip of the mesa, so the horse didn't pay too much attention. Two Meadowlarks. One's voice was right, the other was not. There are two types, Eastern and Western, and they do not sing the same song. Similar, but not exactly the same. Where had I heard an Eastern Meadowlark lately? Evidently, I was thinking of Katie and my trip to Pennsylvania, and, more importantly, the conversation we'd had on the phone at the bar. I kept riding south, but was having trouble remembering why. It wasn't about birds, it was something about a boy, a dead man, and a horse. It felt like I'd been traveling a long way. My head kept nodding until my chin poked into my breastbone. I yanked my head up and opened my eyes, and I was unsure if it was real or a dream. The road was gone, and a thin layer of snow, less than an eighth of an inch, covered the ground and vegetation for as far as I could see into the gloom, except for a perfect circle of dark ground where there was no snow and where nothing grew. The bay stopped and looked at the scene with me. There were no struggling tufts of grass, no sage, nothing. It was as if some flying saucer had landed on top of the mesa, burned all the undergrowth and the thin skim of snow, and then had gone. I exhaled, and my head dropped again, but when I forced my face back up, I could see something in the middle of the circle, like the center of a clock with both hands pointing toward midnight. I knew it was a hell of a lot later than that. I thought about the teepee circles that were part of the landscape in our portion of the country, but I couldn't see any of the rocks that the Indians would have used to mark the periphery. And the circle was too big. Even the Crow and Cheyenne family-sized teepees wouldn't be this large in circumference. Crop circles, maybe. But there were no crops. The bay pulled up a little way from the edge of the circle, then pranced toward it and whinnied. I was just beginning to wonder if it was really a hole and that my tired eyes were playing tricks on me when another lightning strike hit no more than 100 yards to our right. My horse had had enough, and he bolted to the left. I tried to hang on, but this time he pivoted, slipped, and fell. I hit on my side like a load of firewood and felt the air push from my lungs with the impact and a sharp pain in my foot as the bay landed on my boot with an audible crunch. I lay there for a second to get my bearings, assess the damage, and generally feel embarrassed about falling off my horse. For a Westerner, coming unmounted is as shameful as wearing your pants inside your boots, asking somebody how big their spread is, or pissing on the floor of the Alamo. The only good thing about the fall and the excruciating pain in my foot was that it cleared my head enough to think about what I was going to do now that the bay was hightailing it north across the Hardpan Range and disappearing into the darkness. I watched the stirrups bouncing off the horse's sides in a comical interpretation of a TV Western and allowed my head to fall back on the crusted snow. Damn. The hammer of the .45 was digging into my back, and I started to roll over when another streak of pain ran up from my right foot. My eyes watered with the hurt, and I wiped at them. It was then that I saw something at the far edge of the circle. It was something dark and big, and it was rapidly moving my way. I thought it was the owl again, even though it was the wrong color and didn't seem to be flying, and figured maybe he thought he'd found a culinary bonanza. I tried to raise my head, but the pain in my cheekbone made it hard, so I just watched as the big creature stamped the ground and rushed forward to snake out its long neck and snap at my head with huge, clacking teeth. Pain be damned, I yanked back from the edge of the circle and looked up at 1,000 pounds of unrivaled fury. It was a horse, but only in the sense that the headless horseman's horse was a horse. I could hear the clanking of chains where the thing had come unfettered from hell, and I expected fire to blow from its nostrils at any moment. Unable to move any farther, I lay there on my back and watched as the black beast reared on its hind legs and crashed its hooves to the ground only inches from my foot. It stamped at me over and over again. I had found Wahoo Sue. I found a reserve I didn't know I had, and dragged myself back on my elbows as the horse screamed at me and whinnied and snapped the air in an attempt to get free from the nylon halter around her head. She was close enough that I could see where it had rubbed her raw and where the dried blood had stained her dark face. The harness was connected to a heavy, rusted logging chain that was in turn connected to a rock in the middle of the circle, and the length of links had torn and chafed the chest, barrel, and rump of the tortured animal. October 26th, 4 days earlier, afternoon. Mary Barzad's hands had come up again, and she had tried to aim an imaginary rifle despite the restraints at her wrists.
His voice kept telling me to do it. And when I looked at his body lying there on the bed, it was as if I already had shot him. It was as if the blood was already there that I'd already shot him. But the voice was telling me to do it again.
I moved to my right, placed my hands on the footrail of the hospital bed, and looked into her face. You fired the rifle? Tears spilled from her lower lids and highlighted her high cheekbones.
Yes.
How many times? Her head went back as if she'd been struck, and then stayed at that odd angle.
3 times.
I don't think the expression on my face changed, but the facts had. 3 times.
Yes.
Wade Barsad had been shot 6 times. She turned her head toward the light.
He said that he deserved it, said that he deserved to die.
Wade.
Yes.
This time she didn't move.
But the voice that told me to kill him, it was Wade's.
October 31st, 2:30 a.m.
She likes you.
The voice came from the darkness to my left. I could see his outline as I lurched up on one elbow, but I was still having trouble focusing. How can you tell?
'Cause she would have killed you if she didn't, okay?
I stared into the darkness. He had come closer, and I could see his shape more clearly. I'd figured it out, but now that I heard the hard nasal voice like flat stones falling and the signature word, it was confirmed. How are you, Wade? He laughed.
I knew you'd find out. It was just a question of when.
The horse strained against the chain, but this time she directed her fierce aggression toward him. He walked closer, but was careful to stay outside of the circle where Wahoo Sue had licked the snow and nibbled everything else in a desperate attempt to stay alive.
She doesn't like me much, but then the feeling's mutual.
He squatted down in the running shoes and was holding a roll of duct tape.
Just out of curiosity, when did you know it was me?
My head slipped to one side, and I could just make out his face. From the photographs I'd seen, it was indeed Wade Barsad. I flexed my foot and caught my breath again as the pain clamped inside my boot, broken, no doubt about it. Meadowlarks.
I beg your pardon?
Despite the pain, the horse, and the appearance of Wade Barsad, I had to fight against a mounting exhaustion and mumbled, Meadowlarks. He smiled and made a sucking sound with his teeth.
I'm still not following you.
He reached out and shook my shoulder.
Hang in there, Sheriff. I've been dying to have this conversation.
Different song. Wahoo Sue continued to stamp at him, but since he was the one who had staked her, he knew her range.
What? I took a deep breath and let it out slowly, and I think I was drooling. I tried to wiggle my foot again in an attempt to wake up, but the pain had subsided to a throbbing, and my eyes started to close. The Eastern Meadowlark has a song that's different from the Western one. He stared at me.
So?
I tried to concentrate, but my neck muscles had dissolved somehow. On the phone. Supposed to be your brother back in Ohio. But I heard a Western Meadowlark. He sat back on his ankles.
You're shitting me. On the cell phone?
Yep. He was laughing again and leaned back to sit beside me.
Okay, so you're John J. Audubon.
I lay back, thinking that it might be my only chance to keep my sidearm, and stared into the heavily clouded sky. It was your brother, the dentist in the house, burned up. He nodded.
I was getting pressure from my old business associates, and the FBI wanted all of the names and account numbers that I'd written down in exchange for further protection, so I decided to do away with Wade Barsett. I got my brother to fake the dental records for a cut of the insurance money, but I needed a body. Unfortunately for him, it turned out to be his.
You walked Mary through it while she was on the pills.
You know, I was worried about the mob and worried about the FBI, but then you showed up. And I don't even know your name. After I saw you with Van Skyke and the boy, I figured I'd better dope you up before taking you on. That's why I didn't just wait for you at the trailer.
Herschel. He nodded again.
Yeah, I'm sorry about that. I didn't want to kill him. But he ran. And let me tell you, he was some kind of fast when he got going.